Fast am I, good evening, and welcome to this week's episode of Agenda. I'm Ewan Gorn. On the programme tonight, a new push by government to address the climate change challenge, with a 69-question consultation launched to gauge public opinion on the issue, and a planning dispute has arisen in Peel, and finally, do Braddon need to give up their business rates? We hear from the chairman, Andrew Jessop. Politicians behind a new climate change mitigation strategy say they will need the backing of Treasury to achieve their aims. Infrastructure Minister Ray Harmer, Environment Minister Geoffrey Boot and Manx Utilities Chairman Dr Alex Allinson are spearheading a cross-governmental push to cut the island's carbon emissions. DEFA's launched a 69-question consultation to gather public feedback on issues such as energy efficiency, the electrification of vehicles and the transition to low-emission power sources. It's hoped the feedback will help outline what steps the public will be prepared to buy into to reduce emissions by 80% of 1990 levels by 2050. I spoke to Messrs Harmer, Allinson and Boot and first asked the DEFA Minister how much of this strategy was based on the island's previous climate mitigation document.
Principles remain the same, really, reduction of CO2 and a cleaner environment generally. So they're bound to move forward. But what we're looking for is how much further we go, bearing in mind the latest IPCC report and the new targets in terms of CO2 emissions. So we're looking to accelerate the process and get community buy-in as well as cross-departmental cooperation.
And the 67 questions in the consultation, what are they geared towards achieving at the end result?
Well, I'll just take one for example. There's been a lot of opposition to onshore wind turbines, so we thought, well, we'll revisit that in view of the way things are changing. So we've asked two specific questions. Would you support it? And would you support it if you could see it from your window? So we want to get a flavour of what people will buy into in the future. And that applies to a lot of things because it's not going to be an easy journey. I think the transformation or electrification of a greener energy situation without fossil fuels will happen, but it can be costly, but it can be beneficial as well. So we want to find out what people will buy into and what the community will buy into.
And big onus has been placed on cross-departmental working for this going forward. I'd just like to ask Infrastructure Minister, obviously you'll play a vital role in this, particularly surface transport.
Yeah, exactly. So why this is really important is that we need to start planning now for making those sort of real reductions in CO2 emissions, you know, by 2030 and by 2050. So some of the work that we need to do in getting the infrastructure right and working with Manx Utilities and DEFA, for example, getting charging points, how does that influence parking? What legislation do we need in place? What policies do we need to deliver that? And also importantly, we need to lead by example. So it's getting our fleet into low carbon emissions and predominantly electric by 2030. That's why we've made that commitment.
And to charge that fleet, you'll need charging points and possibly tariffs to encourage the public to follow government's lead, and that's where Manx Utilities come in.
Absolutely, this is all of government working together under a common policy, under a common strategy, which is going to be consulted on to deliver what people want. Because I think we've seen with some of the student demonstrations, people want action. That's what they're going to see. We've already seen the demand responsive transport stop empty buses being driven around, and what we need to do now is move towards a very low and then a decarbonised economy. But it's not just all about roads. We need to tackle one of the biggest emissions of CO2, which is people heating their homes and heating their businesses. And that's what Manx Utilities can do by our trial of air source heat pumps and then widening that out as the new normal.
Now, policy and legislation are some of the tools you can use to further the strategy once it's been gone through the consultation and through Timwell. But I'd like to ask, without the backing of Treasury and some serious resource, are you always going to be limited by what you can do?
Well, I made that point when I was answering questions following the statement, and there's going to have to be some serious examination of funding and where we go. Obviously, the community will need to decide whether they pay consumption taxes or whether we as government, which is their money, put money in. In Scotland, they spent a lot of money on modernising or changing homes to a greener agenda with further insulation and different types of heating. And they've been spending around £6,000 a property. Now, I don't see any budget for that at the moment, but certainly from my department's perspective, we will be talking to Treasury.
Will you be making the case for that money? Are you collectively behind finding something to support what you want to do?
Well, exactly. If we're going to move our fleet to low carbon emission fleet, then we will need support from Treasury. But there's also a really big challenge for all of us in terms of our lifestyle, because obviously lower carbon means, you know, active travel means using buses a lot more and making those choices for electric cars, you know, as they become affordable over the next 10 to 12 years. So yes, it's government, but it's all of us.
I completely agree with that, because what we did with the Manx Utilities report was actually at the back show that although electric cars might be a little bit dearer to buy at the moment, the running costs are far, far less. So over a 5-10 year period, you actually get your money back. The same with air source heat pumps. So it isn't all government giving things to people. What we need is a culture change that people will adopt these themselves because they're the right thing to do.
Now, we are tied to certain infrastructure like the power plant till 2030, but I just wanted to get your view on the issuing of a licensing round for hydrocarbon exploration. Now, how does that sit with this? Because it would seem in conflict with what you're trying to do.
I think it's a very interesting question, but I mean, one of the issues is really, and I know there's been demands to actually say, perhaps what we should be measuring is CO2 consumed rather than produced, because it's the consumption that is really driving the behaviour.
But it will emit in other areas contributing to climate change, surely.
But it's still about consumption. That's the first point. The second point is that a lot of these technologies can give you the funds to actually drive reductions in emissions. And we are using gas at the moment, and we will do for a little while, but we need to transition. You can't shock your way into this. It needs proper planning. And that's been very evident to me in an infrastructure point for that. To get to our 2035, 2030 and 2050 targets, we're going to have to make changes now. We're very much living in the decisions that were in the past and the technology of the past. We really need to use that going forward.
But is that short-term environmental cost of, say, if you've got a big oil refinery off Mackled Head, is that short-term environmental cost worth the long-term damage?
Well, can I just say, nobody's going to do an oil refinery off Mackled Head. What we have done on the Isle of Man already is transition between from coal to oil and now to gas to produce our electricity. One of the statistics that's being bandied about is the reduction in the UK reduction in CO2 emissions. That's just because they were still using coal-fired generation and they've turned them all off fairly recently. We've been ahead of the curve on that, and even the IPCC report shows that gas can be used for that transition to a very low or zero carbon economy.
But many countries, I'm thinking New Zealand, there are others, have completely ruled out further exploration for hydrocarbons. Is that not something we can investigate as well?
I think it's all very well to look at other countries, and New Zealand is rich in hydroelectric power and things like that, and wind turbines. If you look at Norway, for instance, Norway is one of the biggest hydrocarbon producers in the world, but they have wisely invested in green energy, so they're using that money constructively. And the same is happening in Scotland. They're one of the larger hydrocarbon producers in the Northern Hemisphere, but they're looking at zero waste and a very green economy for the future, so they're investing that money wisely. And in fact, I'm going to the Orkney Isles later this year to have a look at some of their green energy projects there, which are quite relevant island communities, and what they can do with limited sort of resource in terms of hydroelectric, but lots of wind power and produce hydrogen, for instance, to substitute for fossil fuels. So if in the event of there being a resource there, gas will still be in demand, we can use some of that money, I think, to transition into this greener and more environmentally friendly zero CO2 situation that we want.
In terms of measuring the success of your strategy through to 2030, what will be the performance indicators for you, and who will be holding you to account?
Well, the strategy will set out hard targets for 2025-2030. That will obviously be cross-departmental in terms of reporting. It is our intention to report on an annual basis, so the public will be able to chart our progress through that period. I think the targets we've set, 5,000 electric vehicles, 10,000 by 2030, is very achievable. The average life of a car on the Isle of Man is 10, 12 years. I think most of us will be changing our cars within that period, and I see no reason why a lot of us won't buy electric vehicles.
And there's we've got, as I say, there's very defined targets on electric vehicles for our fleet. That's really important, and also from the number of charging points as well. These are very sort of specific numbers that we will be able to monitor and report on annually.
The measuring of carbon emissions, we last did it in 2016, I believe. Do we do it regularly enough?
It's an annual calculation, but it's about 2 years in arrears. That's nothing to do with us. Our CO2 emissions are monitored along with the UK generally, so there's no reluctance on our part to produce those figures.
Would there be an argument to do it Isle of Man specific, or would that be too costly?
Well, we do sort of provide those figures in essence, but they're amalgamated with the UK. But there's always an arrears situation because you have to collate the information, but we might be able to bring it forward slightly. I'm not making any big promises there.
And just finally, just for the public and indeed the students who came out to make their views known, what assurances can you give them? What confidence can you give them this is the right way forward?
I think the main thing is that yesterday in Tumult, two ministers stood up and talked about climate change, talked about action, talked about taking this seriously, and talked about monitoring the transition to a low carbon economy. This is going to happen. This is the reality. It's how we do it in the right way to bring everyone on board, but government is certainly on board.
Absolutely, and the measures that we take now can have an impact over the next 10, 15 years, but that's why we've been taking it very, very seriously.
From DEFA's point of view, we are obviously taking it very seriously. We've got a new agri-environment scheme coming out shortly, and there are a lot of measures going on behind the scenes that we don't necessarily shout about, but the actual mitigation strategy itself, I think, will be far-reaching and definitely a step in the right direction.
Ministers Geoffrey Boot and Ray Harmer and MUA Chairman Dr. Alex Allenson there. The Deputy Chairman of Peel Commissioners says the board's objection to plans by Empire Garage to build apartments and townhouses was based on material considerations, not just public feeling. Alan Jones chaired the meeting last week in the absence of Christine Mukden, where members voted unanimously to oppose the application. The applicant wants to build a total of 26 flats and 5 townhouses at sites on Marine Parade, Stanley Road and Cross Street, and demolish the existing showrooms, garages and other buildings. A public meeting was also held last week to discuss those plans, with over 100 people in attendance, many of whom opposed the scale of the proposed development. Mr. Jones explained to me how the board arrived at its decision.
A number of us attended the meeting that was held by the residents on Wednesday evening, and from looking at that, certain decisions were made regarding the application to build on those sites.
And what were the objections? You had a number of grounds from which you were concerned about what was being proposed.
Yeah, we follow a template when we look at planning applications, and it's what's considered to be material considerations that you put forward. One of them, which was parking, we felt that this is already, albeit there is parking provided, it's not sufficient for the number of people that were proposed to be living in the area. There were concerns about that it's too big a development to place within that small community of that area, and it would be overpowering and change what is part of one of our conservation areas. So we're very keen to preserve that aspect. I'd just like to make it clear that we are, as a board, we're not opposed in principle to the building or development of those sites. We would like to see that some of those concerns addressed. And they'll be put into detail. I'll be going through that with the town clerk to put forward our objections in detail.
As public representatives, how influential was public feeling on this? You know, the fact that you had just the day before a residents' meeting with 100 people, which is substantial for one of those kinds of meetings. So how much of an influence was public feeling?
It's influential in the sense that we will listen to what they have to say and bear in mind the points raised. However, we as a board have to make our decisions based on material considerations and the guidance given by the planning authority. So that's where we would be going through. We have to be show that we are looking at it in a proper and legitimate manner, not just because of people's emotions and things like that. The board does have sympathy for the residents there, but we all have to recognise that there is a planning system and it is not the easiest of things to go through, and you have to recognise that we have to provide evidence to support any objections that we put forward.
Deputy Chairman of Peel Commissioners Alan Jones. You're listening to Agenda on Manx Radio. The chair of Braddon Commissioners has rejected the claim that business rates income in the parish artificially lowers the costs for domestic ratepayers. Andrew Jessop says, unlike others, his local authority chooses to provide a high level of services in Braddon and aims to make up for a lack of central government investment in the area. A number of questions on changing the collection of business rates have been posed in a consultation launched by the Policy and Reform Minister Chris Thomas in February. Well, I asked Mr. Jessop if Braddon felt picked on by central government in this survey.
We do feel at times that the picking on those three authorities, as you say, Bride, Molew and Braddon, basically diverts attention away from more fundamental problems within government's financing, whether it's local government or central government. But again, it's a question of what you actually do with the income that you receive from that. So I think that this idea of that it's unfair that three of the sort of rural parishes are getting what they claim to be a disproportionate amount from commercial rate isn't necessarily looking at the full picture.
Would you not agree that because of your non-domestic rates, you can artificially keep your domestic rates lower than other authorities can?
No, I don't accept that argument, because again, it's down to the level of services that you provide. If you look at some of the comparisons with other authorities, we're not at an extremely low end. If it was really true, you know, we would only be paying domestic rates of about, say, £1 in the pound, but we're not. You know, it's £2, and it's not that far away from other authorities, some of whom, you know, may be providing some additional services to what we do. Others doing a lot less.
But you can afford to spend money providing better services than other authorities that other authorities couldn't plan for and couldn't ever hope to achieve. Is that fair, considering Braddon is a rural parish as well?
Well, I don't accept that argument either. Everybody could, if they choose to provide services. Generally speaking, you know, with the local authorities, there's a number of services that you have to provide, and then there's a number of services that are sort of like nice to have, and then you've got like sort of the cherry on the top sort of thing that you could do if you've got that additional money. But a lot of the time it's down to what the actual ratepayer wants and what they expect. We haven't been particularly getting any complaints about the level of service and what we choose or not choose to spend the money on. So, you know, again, I don't feel that that sort of criticism is necessarily a fair one.
But maybe no complaints in Braddon, but you've got the financial ability to make these choices, whereas other authorities don't have those choices.
Yeah, but the other thing is that because government is not providing the services that they should be out of central government funding, because for one reason or other, then obviously Braddon is continuing to try and meet that level of service that people are expecting. And so it's not as though, you know, we're just piling money into reserves or just artificially keeping our rates low. We're actually providing a service in many cases which should really be funded by taxation. So if that money's taken away from us, government's not going to do that work. You can guarantee that. A lot of that money they'll take off will just disappear into the pensions black hole.
Do you not think then that an all-Ireland non-domestic rate, using that money for national community policies, that doesn't stick with you as a possible alternative?
If the government wants to say that they want to spread money around more fairly around the island, well, they need to, again, put their own house in order, first of all, and sort out the taxation strategy for the island. We still have a very unfair system whereby if you're very wealthy, as a proportion of your income, you pay very little. But if you're in the squeezed middle in particular, you are the ones that are actually being made to pay for things which should be funded really from elsewhere. So again, just taking it by thinking, well, rates is an easy way of raising additional revenue to fund central government services is not necessarily the right way to go about things.
But would you agree that the current system in terms of rates is unbalanced? Rather than unfair, I know the word fair is a contested one, unbalanced perhaps.
Again, I don't necessarily agree with that argument either. There are maybe some differences between what's raised in different parts of the island. But you've got to remember, again, some of the smaller authorities, they're quite happy not raising an awful lot of money and not providing very much in services. You know, one of the things that Braddon's doing at the moment is providing services free of charge to some of our neighbouring local authorities. So, again, it's not as though Braddon's just taking that benefit. Effectively, there's an example of where Braddon is actually stepping up and actually using that money to assist other authorities.
I accept that Braddon are not stockpiling the extra money they get from the non-domestic rates. They are trying to reinvest them. But it does seem rather random that it's Braddon that has benefited, it's Bride that's benefited, and it's Maloo that have benefited from industrial estates, whereas other areas haven't. It seems a bit arbitrary. And that's, no system is built on a complete random throw of the dice over which authorities should have the benefits.
Yeah, but you've also got to take into account that some of these industrial areas, etc., bring disbenefits as well. And therefore, there are additional costs involved in dealing with these areas. And therefore, I think it's only right and fair that we have that income to actually deal with those additional issues, whether it's a bureaucratic issue, an administrative issue, or actually providing, you know, a higher level of service to actually satisfy the businesses that are actually operating in that area. You've also got the fact that some of these are pretty anti-social types of activity. You may say that there's a level of compensation effectively going to the residents of those areas to have to put up with all the additional disruption, pollution, congestion, whatever, that comes with all that additional development, which in a lot of cases wasn't asked for and wasn't necessarily needed in these areas.
But also in some of those cases, everybody uses those businesses from all over the island as well. So is it fair that just because of where it is, that should be the people who are compensated for where it is?
Well, not necessarily, because again, people, as you say, use some of those services. So again, part of what we're spending that money on is to enable those people to use those facilities that have been provided, whether it's the hospital, whether it's the incinerator in Braddon's case, and in Maloo's case, you know, they've got the airport. So it's not, again, as though it's solely for the purposes and use of the residents and or stroke ratepayers in that area.
You mentioned you didn't think there was an imbalance or an unfairness in the system. When Braddon commissioners can afford to be going on projects like Strand Cornerfield and having new offices, when your current offices, if you don't mind me saying, seem pretty decent compared to some of the smaller local authorities that meet in a, you know, a shed with a corrugated iron roof in the middle of a field, are you sure there isn't an imbalance? I mean, that does seem quite ludicrous.
No, because the change of offices, the existing office, which was originally going to be housing units, isn't 100% ideal because, again, it's a conversion from something that was originally going to be flats. So, yeah, we've been moving into an area within the new development at Strand Cornerfield so that we have offices that are designed for purpose, etc. there. But in terms of that development, an awful lot of that income will actually be generated from activities within the proposed building. It's not something that we were saying, well, we can subsidise the cost of building and running this through the rates. That was never the intention. The idea was always that this would have to wash its face. Again, it's not as though you're saying that it's an extravagance that we can only afford because we've got a high level of rates from commercial users.
But surely you wouldn't be able to progress those plans if you didn't have that amount of the non-domestic rate money.
It might be, you know, some of the scale of it might have been a consideration. But as I said, the whole reasoning behind the building in terms of financing was the fact that it would have to pay for itself and it would not be a burden on the ratepayer.
I just use that as an example. I'm not talking specifically about that. But we'll move on off the domestic rates issue. Just looking at the actual proposal for rating domestic properties, but just more generally, the methodology that they're talking about in this consultation, this property size using aerial photography. What's your initial view on that? I know that you've still got workshops to attend and I'm sure you'll be learning more, but what's the initial reaction to that proposal?
Well, the initial reaction of the board at our meeting the other day was that we just can't understand where that idea had really come from. I know that a couple of people had suggested it in previous consultations, but again, it's potentially going to be just as unfair and as costly an exercise. We find it absolutely amazing that somebody's proposing to spend, you know, hundreds of thousands, potentially millions, in doing this reassessment, revaluation, or whatever they end up with, for no specific change to the amount of money that local authorities are going to be raising. So that's why it seems to me and my board members a total nonsense. If you're not going to be raising any more money than you are now, you're just going to actually look at a few people might pay a little bit more, some are going to pay a little bit less. The majority of people probably end up paying more or less the same. What's the point of spending all that money? The majority of people are not complaining with the system that they've got at the moment.
But the majority of people also don't understand the system we've got at the moment.
That's a case of trying to make it clearer to people how it's calculated.
But they don't understand the relevance of the rentable value of their property in 1969 to taxations today.
Well exactly. Well, if that's the issue, we've suggested it before, you just do a revaluation on the basis of a 2019 rental value of the property.
But Mr. Thomas has suggested that re-evaluation would, I think Tim Wald at the time said it would cost around £2 million to do a traditional revaluation with surveyors. But this aerial one is expected to be about £250,000. It's used in Guernsey as well. Do you not think any difference in terms of changing the system is worth it?
Well, I'm not saying that tweaks aren't necessarily necessary, but what we're saying is that the proposed methodology, you know, again, in terms of having to check every single property to find out whether it's got a basement, first floor, second floor, attic rooms and all the rest of it, that's going to be quite, in my view, unless they've got some secret database somewhere that I'm not aware of that's already done all this work, then, as I say, somebody's going to have to be employed to go around and check all these properties. I think one of the big issues is the fact that this will very much potentially benefit developers who tend to build smaller houses. So if you've got an older property, then again, you could end up being charged more for an older property, which we all know takes more to actually maintain, etc. And therefore, again, it's de-incentivizing people to actually invest money in older property. And that's something that the Isle of Man needs to get a grip of.
Chairman of Braddon Commission is Andrew Jessop, and that's all from tonight's programme. We'll be back with more from Agenda next week, and you can listen again to this episode online as a podcast. But for now, gurumayu, and have a good evening.